Welcome back to Shattering This. I'm sorry that you all had to endure the SRN commercials. They are particularly egregious. One being the woman who is talking about biblical values for immigration. Let me give you a clue here. Other than to tell the citizens of the United States that their egregious action relative to Israel, looting Israel, thinning the nation at the waist through its policy, which is designed to give the mythical people known as the Palestinians, who are an enemy to God and his people, a state, that the consequence of doing that, of trying to appease the Muslims, will be that our largest cities will be destroyed. Other than that, God doesn't say anything about the United States. He has no interest in our immigration policy. There is no biblical standard for immigration policy for any country other than Israel. And to find it, you'd have to take the Torah seriously, which there's not a single Christian on the planet that does. Now, moving on to Christian Mingle. If the Christian Mingle wants to advertise and say that this is a place where people who identify themselves as Christians can go and get their groove on and find other Christians to date, that's just fine. Now, it's pathetic. And that whatever happened to our ability to actually walk up and talk to people, what's happened to people's ability to interact with one another and get to know one another through personal contact, it is sad that the Christian community has had to turn to a dating site, to a computer, to find like-minded individuals. That's pathetic. But when you go to the tagline, find God's match for you, and you infer that God has somehow reverted to using a business to do his bidding, that he is somehow manipulating the software of Christian Mingle to do what he could not otherwise do, that he is going to jettison free will and micromanage people's lives. So that if you meet a person through the computer that you're compatible with, well, then God made that happen for you. But if you don't, then God hates you. That if the person that you meet turns out to be unbearable, then God really hates you. You know, you just kind of wonder why God even bothered with Abraham and Sarah in forming the covenant. I mean, why not get for Abraham an entirely new and better wife and use Christian Mingle to find him a younger, prettier, more prone to be to childbearing wife? Why not with Moshe? Why not use Christian Mingle? Why not, he's God. He can create the computer. He could have created the software and used that technique to bring them together. I mean, this whole thing is so egregious, so disgusting, that a business would pretend that God is working through them to cause Christians to find marriage partners is, I guess it's as pathetic as Tim Tebow thinking that God is responsible for his touchdowns. But I'll tell you what, listening to the SRN advertisers is enough to make you want to scream. It's one of the reasons why Yahweh was screaming with these words. He is saying the same thing that I am saying. He's just being more general, and I was being a bit more specific. He says, "For indeed I, Yahweh, your God, am a zealous and jealous God, a God who is desirous of and even demanding of exclusivity in the relationship, a God who is emotionally passionate and extremely protective of those he loves. Reckoning, recording, assigning, and counting the consequence of twisting and distorting, of inequity, of guilt, of punishment, of perversity, of depravity, of manipulation and unfaithfulness, of wrongdoing, of the fathers upon their children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. And indeed, when you ascribe to God, when you say that your software is the means that God is using to accomplish something, the real God you are despising. When you ascribe those kind of characteristics to God, it is an insult. To say that your political agenda relative to taxation and immigration is God's, as opposed to just coming out and saying, you know, I have these particular views on immigration, and I want you to support my views. Here's where you go and read them, and you can support them financially. Or Christian Mingle. Here I've got a dating website for Christians. If you're looking for a mate and you can't find one the old-fashioned way, here's a good crutch, for a tool for you to use. But when you ascribe these kinds of things to God, as both of them are doing, you're twisting and distorting his nature. What you're doing is detesting and loathing everything he stands for. Now, the creation of and the devotion to false gods and twisted ideology isn't a victimless crime. There is a consequence. When we create and tolerate religions which twist, pervert, distort, and corrupt God's word, as Christianity, Judaism, and Islam do, or ignore Yahweh's testimony, as secular humanism does, our children become unwitting victims of our perversity and infidelity. A child born into the rabbinic culture of Judaism will most likely die separated from Yahweh. So too, a child born into the cultures dominated by secular humanism, Catholicism, or Islam. Religious communities and traditions of men are seductive. They're comforting, and they are beguiling things. They're habit-forming. But by bowing down to and serving their false gods and their worthless idols, families are corrupted. Evil begets evil. We humans reproduce after our kind. A Muslim mother manufactures suicide bombers, not aeronautical engineers. Yahweh not only remembers the perverse words and depraved deeds of those separated from him and what they do to corrupt others, he records the unfaithful acts of our parents too. The only way to break the cycle is to break the idols, all of them, especially religious and cultural ones, and then return to an exclusive relationship with Yahweh. Notice, too, that I said return to Yahweh, not to God, because that's who he is. That's who he says he is. To yada, to know Yahweh, and to return home, we must know and regard his instructions. Knowing that God exists, knowing that there is one God, is of marginal utility. To be saved, one must come to know, respect, and revere Yahweh, and know, respect, and revere his word as he revealed it. Otherwise, your love affair is with a myth. Otherwise, your devotion is to an individual named Christ. And there is no such godly individual. Today, our society's values are so upside down, so polluted. The moral code of socialist secular humanism, called political correctness, most now see the condemnation of false and lifeless doctrines as hateful. So when you tell someone, for example, a Christian, that so long as you continue to place your faith in the testimony of Paul and in a caricature named Jesus Christ, then in the end, you're going to lose your soul. Then in the end, your soul will simply cease to exist, that your religion is false, and that by continuing to believe it, you're shortchanging your future. Now, that is not only accurate, but it is also compassionate. And yet, because of political correctness, it is seen as hateful. You know, to say that Muhammad was among the most perverted individuals who ever lived, and that his religion was astonishingly stupid, and that there is a 0% chance that the Quran was inspired by God, and that therefore killing for Islam is counterproductive on every possible level, is true. It is compassionate. And yet, in the upside-down world of political correctness, it's considered hateful. During the commercial break, I was reading two stories about sports. And in one of those stories, Adrian Peterson is being asked to apologize because he says that he is not supportive of gay marriage. He says, I've got gay family members, love them to death, but I'm not supportive of gay marriage. And he is being asked to apologize, being hounded by the media. You know, in today's world, you either acknowledge the political correct mantra or you're considered unacceptable. Now, mind you, he says, you know, if somebody wants to be a homosexual, that's their business. I don't care. He says, it's just I'm not in favor of it. Now, you're talking about a preference that is so abnormal, less than 2% of society are homosexual. It's unhealthy. Homosexuals live shorter lives. And yet, to say, I'm not in favor of it, I don't care what other people do. It's a choice. You do whatever you want to. I just don't want it promoted as being good. You are hounded by the media today, the evangelists of political correctness. That's how far we have fallen as a society. Groupthink, where we are now polluting our children in our educational institutions and by our media to groupthink, errant groupthink. The inability now exists for people to process evidence rationally as it relates to anything that's important. And so today's our societal values are upside down. Socialist secular humanism and its replacement moral code, political correctness, have rendered the vast majority of people incapable of thinking rationally, and therefore of being judgmental, and therefore of being moral and just. We'll return in a moment. We've been talking about the upside down world of that has been caused really by the pollution of the moral code of socialist secular humanism, which is called political correctness. And what you find is that political correctness is opposed to everything that God is in favor of. If God says, I want you to examine the evidence and then exercise good judgment. In fact, I'm even going to give you a nesalma, the tool for you to be able to exercise good judgment. Political correctness says being judgmental, being discriminating is the single greatest sin. If God speaks of marriage between a man and a woman, political correctness wants to promote marriages between men and between women. If God is talking about the unique contributions that a man and a woman coming together as husband and wife and then mother and father can bring to a family, then political correctness wants to speak in favor of gender choice and of gender transformation and of gender equality. It is a upside-down world. And I say that once you buy into political correctness and the groupthink that results from political correctness, where everybody either goes along or they're considered an extremist and hateful, then what you cease to be is rational. You can't be rational if you cease to be judgmental. You can't be moral. You can't be civil. You can't be just. All of those things are a direct derivative of being judgmental, exercising good judgment. Now, Catholics and secular humanists are particularly adept at hypocritically applying this label of you're hateful, and yet exposing the faults inherent in schemes destined to damn billions is the most merciful thing a person can do. Let me put this in a mundane setting. If your community believed that the sun was the source of long life, and if they were told by their leaders to worship the sun by exposing their bodies to the rays of the sun all day long, would you keep quiet and allow them to shorten their lives based upon its destructive and deadly, their destructive and deadly deception relative to exposure to the sun all day? Would you attempt to save them by exposing the lie and sharing the truth? Muslims take this intolerance thing to a grandiose level, and hypocrisy reigns supreme. They claim that Islam is tolerant because the Quran says there shall be no compulsion in religion. But it also says fight non-Muslims until the only religion is Islam. Not to be outdone in contradiction, Allah's book also says if a Muslim abrogates his religion, kills him. The world over, Muslims have used blackmail, riots, assassinations, kidnappings, and the threat of terrorism to force governments in what was once the free world to pass laws banning any public criticism of Islam. Canada, Australia, Great Britain, France, Germany, and Italy have all passed such bans on free speech. All 50 Islamic nations already have such laws, and the penalty is death. Lifeless lies die when exposed to the light. They thrive in darkness. What has now been labeled the second commandment, but is simply the second of three statements that Yah etched on the first of two tablets, continues with these words. And I will prepare, I will perform, and I will produce. Asha. I will actively effect and appoint. Offer and celebrate. Do whatever is required to effect and to deliver. Unfailing mercy, undeserved favor, and unmerited kindness. Chesed. To thousands, Elip, who love me and who closely observe my terms and conditions, my mitzvah. Here's the contrast. If you corrupt and twist and pervert Yah's testimony, he's going to hold you accountable. And he not only says, I'm going to hold you accountable, but you, in effect, are going to damn your own children. Murdering your own children. So here's the alternative. That God himself, Yahweh, is doing whatever is required to prepare, perform, and produce. He himself. Not some mythical entity out there, some Jesus Christ. God himself, Yahweh, says he is preparing, performing, and producing. Actively affecting. Unfailing mercy and undeserved favor. Unmerited kindness, chesed. So here in the midst of the very heart of the Torah, the book that Christians have been beguiled into thinking is enslaving them and is a series of laws and is diametrically opposed to their concept of grace, here is Yahweh saying that he himself will provide unfailing mercy, undeserved favor, and unmerited kindness to thousands. Now, who are those thousands? Returning to what has been called the second commandment, there, by the way, are no commandments among the 10 statements that Yahweh etched in stone. There's only one that's even written in the imperative mood, and it is the one that is the most impossible to view as a command, which is showing respect for your mother and father, and it's not your earthly mother and father that God is encouraging you to show respect for. Here, just in the second statement, he is condemned fathers for corrupting their children. So you wouldn't want to respect someone who is in the process of corrupting their children. It's pretty obvious in context, which is something that the world has lost sight of, that the mother and father that he is describing are our Heavenly Father and Spiritual Mother. Spiritual Mother is the Ruach Kodesh, or set-apart spirit. The other thing that is just amazing, particularly in context, is Yahweh himself engaging to provide mercy. And yet Christians believe that the Torah is a set of laws which condemn and that there is no mercy in the Torah. And yet the statement that God etched in stone says that he is the provider of mercy. He prepared it. He produces it. and that his mercy is unearned favor and unfailing kindness. It is unmerited what he does on our behalf, and yet they have created a religion based upon the cute little naked girls called the Graces to replace this notion, to replace this idea, this myth that the Torah has no mercy. God instead, in the midst of his Torah, on the statement that he etched in stone, I will prepare, perform, and produce, I will actively affect, personally, unfailing mercy, unearned favor, and unmerited kindness, chesed. Now, it's interesting here that that it is to few. Now, he's talked about the fathers corrupting their children to the third and fourth generation, and yet now when he's talking about mercy, it's to thousands. Now, you might view thousands as being a lot more than a few. Well, in some context, it is. But in the context of the billions who have come this way, 1,000 or thousands amongst billions, I should say, for the right comparison, is one in a million. Thousands amongst billions is one in a million. What God is saying here is that approximately one in a million individuals avail themselves of his mercy. Now, could it be a little more than that? Yeah, I suspect, and still be consistent with his testimony. But when Yosha said few find the way to life, and that most go the popular way, which leads to the death and destruction of one soul, he was reiterating what God said here in the second of three statements on the first of two tablets. Thousands. Now, how does one become one of the fortunate thousands? Well, God gives two qualifiers. First is that they love Yahweh, that they choose to form a close and affectionate familial relationship with Yahweh. It's a hob. Can you love someone you don't know? Of course not. That would be infatuation, not love. If you don't know God's name, is there any chance that you really know him? If you don't care for and reject Yahweh's Torah, which is his invitation to get to know him, what are the chances that you actually know him as he is? If you're praying to a Jesus Christ, what are the odds are that you actually know Yahweh? Remote in the extreme. To love someone, to genuinely engage in an affectionate relationship with them, you have to know them as they are. You have to engage with them. You have to participate in that relationship with them based upon who they actually are. And the only place where God introduces himself to us and tells us who he is in the Torah. That's why he says that the means to love, the means therefore to mercy, is to closely observe, shamar, to carefully examine, to carefully consider his mitzvah, his terms and conditions. What are his terms and conditions? What is mitzvah? Mitzvah is the codicils of the contract. It's the instructions, it's the prescriptions for the covenant. The covenant has five terms and conditions. You want to receive Yah's mercy? Closely examine and carefully consider the terms and conditions of the covenant. Now, he's saying that there is a two-step process here. You first have to come to know God, because the relationship, the covenant relationship, is with him. It would be stupid in the extreme to engage and act upon the five conditions of the covenant if you don't first come to know and like the individual with whom you're forming a relationship. So God says, first, you got to come to love me. And you can't come to love God unless you first come to know him. So the prerequisite here for mercy is coming to know who Yahweh is. And then after you come to know who he is, as he presents himself, deciding that you rather like the individual you're coming to know. And then beyond liking, that you go to say, you know, I love him. I really do. I love him. Now, that requires a depth of understanding that isn't possible unless you're serious about the relationship. Easy to be infatuated, but to actually love requires a depth of understanding and participation in a relationship with an actual individual, not with a caricature like a Jesus Christ. So it begins with coming to know Yahweh, understanding who he is, what he represents, what he is offering that enables us to come to respect him, to like him, and then to love him. But it doesn't stop there. Simply loving God because you've come to know him and you respect and like and revere that which you have come to know isn't enough. Based upon your affinity and affection for him, the next step is to pay attention to carefully examine and closely consider the terms and conditions of his covenant. You notice here there's nothing about faith. There's nothing about belief. This is engaging in a relationship with a real individual at the exclusion of all other potential candidates, and doing so because you've come to know them, and based upon knowing them, you've come to respect and love them, and because you have paid attention to the terms and conditions of the relationship they're offering, and that you've acted upon those. That's the means to mercy. It's the only means. If you don't know the terms and conditions of the covenant, you can't be saved. If you don't know Yahweh as he is, you can't be saved. His mercy is available to those who have come to know him, who respect him, come to like him and love him as he is, and those who have closely examined and carefully considered the terms and conditions of his covenant and have acted upon them. That's it. There is no other means to mercy. And because that's it, and God etched this in stone, and he is not going to go back on his testimony, thousands are the beneficiaries of his mercy. Now, if more people closely examined and carefully considered his terms and conditions of his covenant as that's presented in his Torah, then thousands would become tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions. God is just telling you the way it is. He's not saying, you know, I only want 1,000 people, or 5,000 people, or 10,000 people, or 20,000 people to be the beneficiaries of my mercy so that they can participate in my covenant and therefore be saved by me. He's not saying that is my goal, that is my ambition. He's just reporting the facts. Just like in the previous statement, he's not saying, I want fathers to corrupt their children. He's just presenting the facts. He says fathers do corrupt their children. He's presenting the facts here. Thousands will avail themselves of Yah's mercy. And they will do so by coming to know him as he actually is, coming to fall in love with him because of who he actually is, and then examining and considering the terms and conditions of his covenant and acting upon them. So God is forgiving. His mercy is limitless. But, and this is a big one, he only forgives those who seek his forgiveness in accordance with his instructions. Seek mercy from the wrong spirit or in the wrong way, and you'll find out just how worthless faith in the wrong object and institution can be. For those who believe that expressing one's faith in Paul's gospel of grace overcomes the Torah's restrictive legalism, think again. Here, Yah is equating love for him with a reverence and respect for his terms and conditions, his directions, his instructions, and his prescriptions, which is to say, his Torah. If you disregard your father's instructions, especially those which are good for you, you are displeasing him. And that is especially true for our Heavenly Father. And that is why this same message serves as the basis for the second of seven instructions that were delineated by God himself on the second of these two tablets. Finally, as I have mentioned, Aleph means thousands. That isn't a very big number, especially compared to the tens of billions of people who have been born of Adam. Compared to the billions, it suggests that one in a thousand thousand will benefit from Yahweh's mercy. That's one in a million. According to the message chiseled in stone, Yahweh said, I will produce what is required to deliver mercy and honor and favor to thousands who love me and who closely observe and examine my terms and conditions, my instructions, my directions. Just as Yahusha said at the conclusion of his teaching on the Mount, that he was the way to life, and that the way to life was a narrow path, was a narrow gateway, a narrow doorway, and few there are who find it. God is saying the same thing here. In fact, this is why Yahusha said that the way to life is narrow, that that doorway is narrow, and few find it. One in a million would indeed be few. Heaven will not be a very crowded place. 10,000 from 10 billion is one in a million. However, a whole lot more than Adam will be there, and God created the whole universe for him alone. Yes. And if there are over a billion Muslims, based upon their popularity alone, these religious paths to God are disqualified as being recipients of Yah's mercy. And yet, another sobering thought, this is for believers. When you recognize that God said thousands, and that thousands amongst billions is one in a million, there is no chance whatsoever, based upon what he etched in stone or what Yahusha said during the Sermon on the Mount, that either Christianity or Islam or even socialist secular humanism can be the means to salvation. Since loving Yahweh is directly related to closely and carefully observing his testimony, his Torah, the place where the terms and conditions of his covenant are presented. Corrupting his message, therefore, would be the antithesis of loving him. We're going to consider that in a moment, but we have our friend Glenn calling in from Philadelphia, this time, I understand, on Noah's lineage. Hello, Glenn.
How are you? Yeah, not quite. Well, not quite Noah's lineage. But to base, and I don't recall if we've touched on this before, but and it's kind of a bit of a digression from what you've been doing, but I imagine you have a pretty good quick answer. We often hear about you know, the issue of people being anti-Semitic these days, and I find this like a bit ironic, given that, like, especially when dealing with things having to do with the nation of Israel, in which the Ashkenazi influence predominates these days, almost to the point of making Sephardis or, you know, other, you know, Mizrahi Jews second-class citizens. But what bothers me about this is if Ashkenazis are indeed descendants of Ashkenaz, they are further than descendants of Japheth rather than Shem, and hence not Semitic. In order to be Semitic, one must be descended from Shem. So yeah. I'm wondering what your take on this is.
Yeah, first of all, one of the issues with being a descendant of Shem, since it's such a broad categorization, you're dealing with the two peoples that are the most viciously opposed to one another. Arabs would be also Shemites, as are most Jews. So to say you're anti-Semitic is probably a really bad label in today's parlance. We ought not have to revert to Shem for our racial hatred and our discussions of racial hatred. But the term really has morphed into being anti-Jewish, is what the term means.
I just wish they would say that.
Yes, yeah, so
you
just say anti-Jewish. The from God's perspective, to be Jewish, since he doesn't use the term Jewish, he uses the term Yahud, and then he also uses Yisrael, because while Yahuda is the central tribe from his perspective in terms of what he's trying to accomplish, but collectively the all of the tribes are under the umbrella of Yisrael, because Jacob, who is the father of the 12 tribes, Jacob was renamed Yisrael, and so Yisrael is the collective Yehuda, and Yehudim would be one of the 12. You know, even to say you're opposed to Jews, it also gets into that issue. Well, you know, they're all not Yehuda. Most are Yisraelite, and Yehuda is just a subset of Yisraelite. And so even there is an issue. But I happen to agree with you. I think that the term anti-Semitism is really a bogus term, that we'd be far better off using the term anti-Israel.
Okay. And for, like, I guess for another day, because time's wasting here, but I called in late. The name Yisrael, the name El in it, which begs the question of the Yahwist versus the Elohist in the Torah. And, you know, you yourself talked about how El can be Saturn. So, you know, maybe someday you can hold forth on that distinction sometime.
Yeah, God uses the title El from Eloah. It's a shortened form of Eloah. It's used primarily as Elohim, which is the plural form of Eloah. Eloah, and therefore El and Elohim mean mighty one. It's simply a title. It does mean God. In the title and name Yisrael, it's individuals who engage and endure with God. Now, God happens to have one name, but we can talk about the name debate versus title debate in another program, and I'm confident, Glenn, that you'll call in. We'll have more time to do so. It's the end of our program today. Thank you, Glenn, for your questions, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.